With my customary perspicacity and latter-day juvenescence, I can only remember three names at a time. There are a couple of other visitors I should certainly mention. One is Vicki Culver's son, Brett, who has grown up remarkably, and whom you will wish to see, those of you who knew them well. And another guest who played the prelude and the offertory music, George Titsworth. We're glad you're here, George, and Wanda as well. The sermon this morning is a response to two questions. A young college couple came recently to talk about getting married in this church, but they wanted to know what a congregational church believes. And as I talked to them about that, and why I so gladly became a Congregationalist after growing up in a fundamentalistic church, they said almost in unison, "When did you begin to change and why? And how do you feel about those other religions?" By which they meant not Baptists, but Buddhists. Not the Methodist faith, but the Islamic. They were serious and they were intelligent. And some of the things I said to them, I decided later might be useful to some of you when the extended family gets together and the kids are home from college and the talk turns to religion. I should tell you before I go further that agreement with what the minister says on any given Sunday morning is not a requirement in this place. I explained to those two how I first found out when I was 19 and 20 years old that religion depends enormously on culture. My faith as a teenager was determined first by where I lived, and more specifically by the particular church my strong-willed and dearly beloved father insisted was right, not just for himself, but for my mother, my sister, and myself. And it simply did not occur to us to doubt. Father knew best. If we were the only church, which is what we were taught each week, and if our preachers could prove this with irresistible logic and scripture, then it seemed obvious to me that the best thing I could do would be to become one of those preachers myself. And so my first 2 years away from home were spent in an odd, but as I look back, wonderful place, a combination of college, seminary, and monastery, 500 miles away from home, or really next door, depending on how one looked at it, because in terms of religion, I simply took home along with me. The college was sponsored by the same church I had grown up in. It hired as faculty only certified true believers in its particular brand of Protestant faith, and it relentlessly defended our doctrine 5 days a week in chapel as the only doctrine God could possibly approve. In other words, 500 miles from home, I was still in the capsule. But the glory of life is that accidents can happen, even in a capsule. I had often heard my childhood preacher make fun of Thomas Paine's famous old book, The Age of Reason, calling Paine an atheist whose book had sent thousands to hell. What a terrible man, I thought, although I had never read a single line of the book. But one day, rummaging around in the library of this small denominational college in Tennessee, I came upon a copy of the age of reason, dust covered and undisturbed for years in that holy place, and with a delicious little shudder of guilt, I opened it up to see what awful blasphemies had so upset my hometown preacher. This was the opening sentence. I believe in one God and no more, which means he was Unitarian rather than Trinitarian, and I hope for happiness beyond this life. In the opening sentence, I discover that he believes in God and he believes in immortality. I stood there in the dim and dusty stacks thinking, how strange to call this man an atheist. And then the first tiny hole appeared in my watertight mental dike. Either my minister didn't really know what an atheist was, or else he hadn't read Paine's book at all and was simply echoing what he'd heard some other preacher say. And if that were true, perish the thought, maybe he had been wrong about other things as well, and I needed to think about religion for myself. I went back to my room and read every word of Paine's book, but there was no sudden change in me. I was too well trained in the doctrines of my church to accept much of what Paine said about Christianity and about the true nature of the Bible and its composition. We do not learn, remember, please, we do not learn things, no matter how many times they are told to us, until we are ready to learn them. And most of the seed sown in my mind by that heretical little book lay passively on hard, unfriendly soil for years before it could sprout. There are much better books available now than Thomas Paine's book on the same topics. It just happened to be the one I stumbled upon first. It was so much fun to be intellectually sinful in that pious place that I found in the city library another of his books, The Rights of Man, from which I saved a paragraph about the different religions in the world and how God might feel about them. The late 18th century style is a bit too stiff and formal for a listening audience, but a paraphrase would go something like this. Imagine a large family of children who like to give their parents tokens of their love and gratitude. Because of their differences in taste and talent and understanding, each makes a different offering and in a different way. Some pay tribute in verse or in a letter, some by an object of art, lovingly fashioned, some by an act so simple as gathering wildflowers and taking them home in person. Each expression of love delights the parents. They enjoy the variety. And now an exact quote from Paine. But of all unwelcome things, he says, nothing could more afflict the parents than to know that the whole of them, that is, all the kids, had afterwards gotten together, grabbing each other by the ears, boys and girls fighting, scratching, reviling, and abusing each other about which was the best or the worst gift. Well, I got the point, although at the time I could not accept it, that in every culture, the human family tries to express thanks to a creative power and to bring gifts of hand or heart which make sense from each community's experience. What would sadden Thomas Paine is that in 1994, 200 years later, the children are still fighting over whose gift is appropriate. Irish Catholic versus Irish Protestant, Islamic fundamentalist versus the wicked Christian West. Sometimes, I'm glad to say, and in some places, we do a little better. I remember sitting one Sunday afternoon in the overheated basement of First Presbyterian Church downtown to learn what my congregational church might do about sponsoring a Buddhist Vietnamese family. I couldn't help thinking as I watched a Catholic priest standing beside a Lutheran social worker how far we have come in tolerating religious differences. It was not so very long ago in England that Catholics were not allowed to practice their faith, could not hold most jobs, could not travel more than 5 or 10 miles from home, and were immediately blamed in any disturbance or suspected plot against the government. Much more recently in this country, the idea of a Catholic as president was unthinkable before John Kennedy. On the cynical side, I suppose you could argue that we just don't care enough anymore, that our tolerance actually comes from dying conviction, but I doubt that. I think other forces are at work. For one thing, there are more people alive at this moment in the United States than ever before in its history who have traveled in other countries and, platitude or not, travel does widen sympathies and makes us more tolerant of diversity in religion. Because if character is the ultimate test of faith, now listen, remember the remark of Christ, by their fruits you shall know them. If character is the ultimate test of faith, then it quickly becomes clear to a world traveler, as the Apostle Paul said in the book of Acts, that in all nations, God has left some witness of himself. Millions of men and women who left their own country and saw the simple decency of people who had once been known only as foreigners to them have never been quite as dogmatic as they were before. So those two kids in my office, I haven't forgotten them, were not much surprised when I said, I cannot imagine Christianity's being the only faith by which people may come to spiritual sensitivity or a knowledge of what we call the divine. I watch, let's say, Billy Graham's latest convert, a youngster coming down the aisle in a huge football stadium, swayed by carefully managed music and crowd pressure and professional rhetoric, a youngster with almost no knowledge at all of Christianity and with a faith still totally untested. And I am supposed to think that he is saved, to use the conventional phrase, while a devout Buddhist who through a lifetime has meditated on truth and practice the highest way of life he knows is by a just and loving God excluded from favor. I cannot manage that. I say this in spite of the claim Jesus is said to have made that no one comes to the Father but by him. I understand that quite differently from the way I once did. And I am not unique in my understanding of it. The Hebrew scripture had often pictured God as a jealous and even violent tyrant. I think Jesus is saying, You will hear from me that God is a father, and never anything but a father, and that any way of seeing him which contradicts that insight is imperfect. And footnote, if Jesus had spoken out of a matriarchy, he would have said God is a mother, and he would have meant the same thing. To put it another way, if God represents the ultimate in love and justice and mercy, then the way of Christ, the way of love and justice and mercy, is the road by which we come to God, and the only road by which we come to God. But the way of Christ is obviously not limited to people with some historical knowledge of a Galilean rabbi. Hebrew Scripture talks of people who walked with God long before Christ came along with his expanded definition of God. And as Paul said, even among the majority who know nothing of Christ, God has left a witness of himself. An English professor, who was also a missionary for some time in the Far East, remembers a certain Japanese Buddhist for whom he said the word Christ-like was the perfect description. He adds that a Japanese woman, head of a school in Osaka, says she became a Christian through her contact with that same Buddhist. Now there's a nice touch. An Oriental woman becomes a Christian by knowing a Christ-like Buddha. This, I think, is what Christ meant when he said, I am the way, that his life is the way, that there are certain universal qualities of mind and spirit by which all people come to the highest knowledge. If Christ embodied those qualities, as I believe, then wherever we go, we should discover at least a latent Christ in the hearts of people who seek in love and gentleness to know the name of the highest. And this is exactly what happens. Missionaries have said over and over that when they draw their portrait of Christ, their listeners recognize an image they have already cherished in their hearts. I like to believe that when a congregational church provides money for foreign missions, it does so in the conviction that love comes before knowledge, just as it does in the nurture of our children, and that what we are doing is sharing love in practical ways, like educating the untaught, healing the sick, growing better wheat, reclaiming the desert, the kind of thing Paul has in mind when he says, knowledge puffs up. Not always. This is a generalization. But often enough for him to make it. Knowledge puffs up. Love builds up. Some of the missionaries I remember from my boyhood thought they took all the correct knowledge there was in the world to foreign countries as missionaries. Some of them seemed sadly deficient in sacrificial love and understanding and tolerance. I like to think that we never forget in this church how Christ said, we must judge others not by their labels, but by their fruits. And how when he imagines a judgment scene, bases approval not on how sophisticated our theology is, but on whether love has expressed itself through feeding the hungry, clothing the naked, visiting those who are sick and in prison, providing a home for the homeless stranger. The only time Christ ever spoke of a judgment scene That was the basis for approval. Whenever we're tempted to exalt knowledge above caring, we need to remember that the Christian religion is not unique. Hear this carefully too, please. It is not unique for the body of knowledge it transmits, but for the concern it brought into the world. Most of the knowledge was secondhand. Most of the knowledge was secondhand, gathered from the best of Judaism, which had already borrowed itself from Egypt and Babylon and other assorted cultures. You find almost nothing in the New Testament by way of knowledge that is new or unique. You find unique love, and that is the glory of that scripture and the Christian religion. A certain book in my library called The Influence of Greek Thought on Christianity is not just a fantasy on the part of Oxford scholar Edwin Hatch. Even when Christ said something as famous as this, "A new commandment I give to you, that you love one another," he was actually quoting an Old Testament precept which had been spoken so many centuries before that perhaps he felt it had been forgotten. The fact is that when intelligent Christians, Buddhists, Hindus, Jews, Muslims sit down together to talk over their faith with mutual respect, they find beneath their differences profound areas of unity. This is not to say that one religion is as good as another, which is a ridiculous statement, but only that for the most part, they are like inverted pyramids, all coming down to certain basic laws of the Spirit on which most of us agree. But still there are differences. In Swiss hotels, instead of Gideon Bibles, I found Buddhist scripture. And while occasionally I was not inspired by it, I was amazed at other times how often my own scripture was echoed. And more than once I found ideas and ways of expressing them that I wished were in my own scripture. Topics on which it does not speak, topics on which it speaks ambiguously. I dare to make that kind of honest comment, I suppose, because I am so powerfully bonded to the Christian faith, and because for me the way of Christ is the clearest avenue I know to life at its best. But I know also perfectly well that if I had grown up Jewish, Buddhist, Muslim, Baha'i, Confucian, I would probably be worshiping in a very different way this morning. How better can I sum this up than by quoting the Apostle Paul preaching in Athens to people who did not know his God at all and saying that he agrees with their poets who claim, "We are indeed his children." Poets for what we would call an idolatrous nation, writing, "We are indeed his children." And Paul agreeing, and then trying very courteously to bring them up to his level by saying, "If then we are the children of God, we ought not to imagine God in terms of gold or silver or stone contrived by human art or imagination." Paul graciously includes them in the family and invites them to grow up, to nurture their faith toward maturity. I could do that in good conscience to worshipers around the world without supposing, if they rejected me, that God had necessarily rejected them, and without falling into deep depression because I had failed to convert them to my own level of understanding. I once knew, I really did know a young man who literally went mad over the thought that most of the world was hopelessly lost and that thousands of them were dying in that condition whenever he took time away from eating, from teaching or preaching, to eat or sleep. He spent days, I jumped ahead of myself. This young man grew up in the same church I did. He believed that if you were not a member of that church, you were hopelessly lost. And he went without sleep so much and was so nervous about his failure to be out constantly preaching that he had to be committed at last to an institution. Now, there isn't any hint of that in the life of Christ. You never get the feeling of hysteria, of being pressured by time. He spent all those weeks in the desert. He went to parties. He had time for children. He believed, it seems to me, that in God's grace, those who do the best they know are protected by the same grace that I need myself. Once we catch on to how large the family may be, then perhaps we will learn from each other how to be wiser and better children. It is my personal conviction that one can be the most devoted Christian on earth and believe such things.